And now it's time for the Northern Storyteller. Hello, I'm Ellen Pritchard. Today I'll be reading two stories from the book The Flying Trunk by Hans Christian Andersen. The Jumpers. A flea, a grasshopper, and a frog once wanted to see which one could jump the highest, and they asked the whole world to come to see them. All three were well-known jumpers. "I'll give my daughter to the one who jumps the highest," said the king, who thought it would look strange to have those well-known jumpers jump for nothing. On the day they were to jump, the flea came forward first. As he was of good blood and used to being with men, he was very polite and bowed to everyone on all sides. All this was most important. Then next came the grasshopper. He was heavier than the flea, but he was also very polite. He was dressed in his beautiful green clothes. He said that he was from an old Egyptian family, which was highly admired. He also said that he had just come in from the fields and was now living in a three-storied paper house. "I sing so well," said the grasshopper, "that 20 grasshoppers have lost their voices trying to match me. Those poor grasshoppers have always wanted a paper house." And the flea and the grasshopper told an excellent story about themselves. Each thought that he was good enough to marry the princess. The frog came forward last, but he said nothing. People said that his keeping still meant that he thought more. When the court dog hardly smelled him, everyone knew that the frog came from a good family. The old counselor, who had had three orders to keep everyone quiet, said that the frog was very unusual. One can tell by looking at the frog's back if there will be cold weather. That is more than one can see even on the back of the weatherman. "Well, I won't say anything," said the old king, "but I will do my own thinking." Now the jumping would decide which one of the three jumpers would marry the princess. First, the flea jumped. He jumped so high that no one could see where he landed. The people said that he'd not jumped at all. This, they thought, was very wrong on the part of the flea. When the grasshopper jumped, he jumped right into the king's face. The people did not like this and pushed the unlucky grasshopper to the side of the road. The last to jump was the frog. He stood very quiet for a long time. He stood so long that the people thought he could not jump. "As long as he can jump," thought the court dog. He smelled the frog again. The frog jumped a little to one side into the lap of the princess, who was sitting on a low couch. Then the old king said, "The highest and the most beautiful jump was the frog's jump. It was indeed very clever of him to jump into my daughter's lap. That jump called for a head. The frog showed that he has a good head, and also that he uses it. He shall have the princess for his wife." And so the frog was given the princess for his bride. "Well, I jumped the highest," said the flea. "It does not matter. Let the frog have her, but I did jump the highest. Good looks are all that people want these days." And the flea went away to war. It was said that he was killed. The grasshopper sat by the side of the road and thought about all things in this world. After much thought, he decided at last, one must be good-looking. And then the poor grasshopper sang his sad song from which this story was taken. This may not be a true story, but it's in a book. What the Old Man Does is Always Right. I'll tell you the story which was told to me when I was a little boy. Every time I think of the story, it seems to become more and more delightful. It is with stories, as it is with many people. They become better as they grow older. In the country, there's a very old farmhouse with a straw roof and small plants growing wild upon the roof. On the highest part of the roof, a bird has its nest. The walls of the house are lean, and the windows are low. Only one of the windows is made so that it will open. The cupboard sticks out of the wall like a little fat body. A tree hangs over the wooden wall, and under its branches at the end of the wall is some water in which a few ducks are amusing themselves. Then there's a yard dog, too, who barks at all callers. Jeff Stutz's farmhouse stood out in the country, and in this house lived an old couple, a farmer and his wife. Their land was so small that they felt they could do without their horse, which had to make its own living by eating the grass that found by the side of the highway. The old farmer always rode into the town on his horse. Sometimes his friends would use it, and in return would do something for the old couple. But the farmer and his wife thought it would be better if they traded the horse for something that might be more useful to them. But what might this something be? "You know that best, old man," said the wife. "It is fair day today, so go into town. Try to get money for the horse or make a good trade. Whatever you do will be right for me. Go off to the fair." She put on his tie for him, for she could do that better than he could, and she tied it in a bow, for she could do that very prettily. Then she rubbed his hat down and round with her hand and gave him a kiss. He rode away upon the horse that was to be traded. Yes, the old man knew what he was about. The sun shone down, and not a cloud was to be seen in the sky. The road was very crowded, for many people, all going to the fair, were driving or walking upon it. No place could be found anywhere to get away from the burning sun. Among the people, a man was walking along and driving a cow to the fair. The cow was as beautiful a creature as a cow could be. "Oh, that's good milk, I'm sure," said the farmer. "That would be a very good trade, the cow for the horse." "You there with the cow," he called. "I'll tell you what, a horse is worth more than a cow, but I don't care for that. A cow would be more useful to me. If you'd like, we'll trade." "Oh, to be sure I will," said the man, and they made the trade at once. Now that the horse was traded, the farmer might have turned back, for he'd done what he'd come to do. But as he had decided to go to the fair, he felt that he must go anyway. Yes, just let him look at it. So he went on to town with his cow. He walked on with the animal. After a short time, he overtook a man who was riding a sheep. It was a good fat sheep with fine wool on its back. "I should like to have that sheep," said the farmer to himself. "He would find enough grass to eat beside the road, and in the cold weather we could keep him in the room with us. It would be more useful for us to have a sheep instead of a cow. Shall we trade?" The sheep was quite ready, and the trade was made, and the farmer went along the highway with his sheep. Soon he overtook another man who came into the road from the field carrying a large goose under his arm. "That's a very heavy thing you have there. It has enough feather in the back. It would look good tied to a string and swimming in the water at our place. That would be something for my old woman. She could make all kinds of money out of it. Many times she has said, 'Oh, if we only had a goose.' Well, now she can have one. Yes, if possible, it shall be hers. Shall we trade? I'll give you my sheep for your goose, and a thank you besides." They traded, and then the farmer became the owner of the goose. This time he was very near the town. The crowd on the highway became greater and greater. People walked in the road and close by the wall. Outside the city, they even walked into the gatekeeper's field near the city gate. In the field, the gatekeeper's hen was walking about with a string tied to its leg, so that if it could take fright at the crowd and run away, it would not be lost. This hen had short feathers and looked very wise. "Bah, bah," said the hen. What it thought when it said this, I cannot tell you, but as soon as our good man saw it, he thought, "That's the finest hen I've ever seen in my life. Why, it's finer than any other hen in Denmark. On my word, I should like to have that hen. A hen can always find a seed or two and can almost keep itself. I think it would be a good trade if I could get that for my goose." "Shall we trade?" he asked the gatekeeper. "Trade?" asked the man. "Well, that would not be a bad thing." And so they traded. The gatekeeper at the city gate kept the goose, and the farmer carried away the hen. Now, he had done much trading on his way to the fair, and he was warm and sleepy. He wanted something to eat and something to drink. Soon he was in front of an inn. He was just about to step through the door when the innkeeper came out. The innkeeper was carrying a sack. "What have you in that sack?" asked the farmer. "Rotten apples," answered the innkeeper. "A whole sack full of them, enough for the pigs." "Can they not be better used? I should like to take them to my old woman at home. Last year the old tree by the water hole gave only one apple. We kept it in the cupboard until it was quite rotten. It's always something to own, my old woman said. Here she could see us all whole sackful. Yeah, I'll be glad to show them to her.
What will you give me for the sackful? Asked the innkeeper.
What will I give?
Well, I'll give my hen in trade.
And he gave the hen and took the apples which he carried inside the inn. He leaned the sack carefully against the fireplace and then went to the table.
But the fireplace was very warm. He had not thought of that. Many guests were present, horse traders, cattle traders, and two Englishmen. The two Englishmen were very rich. Their pockets were so full that gold pieces almost fell out. The Englishmen could wager, too, as you shall hear.
Why, do you know, said the farmer.
Then he told the whole story, from the horse that he had changed for a cow, and all of it down to the apples.
Well, said one of the two Englishmen, you're in for trouble. What will your wife say?
What will my wife say, said the farmer.
She'll kiss me and say, what the old man does is always right.
Shall we wager, said the Englishman.
We'll wager gold pieces. 100 sacks of gold to 100 sacks of apples.
Oh, one sack will be enough, said the farmer.
I can only set the one sack of apples against it. And I'll throw myself and my old woman into the wager.
Done. Taken.
And the wager was made. A coach came up, and the Englishman got in, and the farmer got in, and away they went. Soon they stopped before the farmer's house.
Good evening, old woman.
Good evening, old man. I've made the trade.
Yes, you know what you're about, said the woman.
And she kissed him, not noticing the two guests or the sack.
I got a cow in trade for the horse, said he.
Oh, God, be thanked, said she. Oh, what wonderful milk we shall now have, and butter on the table.
That was a wise trade.
Yes, but I changed the cow for a sheep.
Ah, oh, that's better still, cried the wife. You always think of everything.
We've just veiled enough for sheep.
We'll have sheep's milk and woolen clothes. The cow cannot get those, and her hairs would only come off.
How you think of everything.
But I changed away the sheep for a goose.
Oh, then this year we shall really have goose to eat, my dear old man.
Oh, you're always thinking of something to give me pleasure.
How delightful that is.
We can let the goose walk about with a string to her leg and
we'll flatter still before we cook her.
But I gave away the goose for a hen, said the man.
A hen? Oh, that was a good trade, said the woman.
The hen will lay eggs and sit on them and we shall have chickens.
We shall have a whole yard of chickens.
Oh, that's just what I was wishing for.
Yes, but I traded the hen for a sack of rotten apples.
What?
Oh, I must kiss you for that, exclaimed the wife.
Oh, my dear good husband, now I'll tell you something. You know, you had hardly left me this morning before I began thinking how I could give you something very good this evening.
I thought it should be pancakes, and I had eggs and meat, too, but I wanted flowers to put on the table. So I went over to the school teacher. I remembered that there were flowers there, but the school teacher's wife is a mean woman, though she looks so sweet. I begged her to give me a handful of flowers.
There, she answered me, nothing at all grows in our garden, not even a rotten apple.
I could not even give you a rotten apple, my dear woman.
Well, now I can give her 10, yes, even a whole sackful.
That I'm very glad of.
Oh, that makes me laugh.
And with that, she gave the old man a big kiss.
I like that, exclaimed both Englishmen together.
Always going down and always merry.
That's worth the money.
And they made good their wager at once. 100 sacks of gold to the old farmer, who was not struck but kissed.
Yes, it always pays. When the wife always says that her husband knows best and that whatever he does is right.
You see, that's my story. I heard it when I was a child. Now, you've heard it too and know that what the old man does is always right.
You've been listening to stories from The Flying Trunk by Hans Christian Andersen, published by Scott Forsman.
Northern Storyteller is a production of KUACFM at the University of Alaska, Fairbanks. Our program is coordinated by Ron Inouye. Our engineer is Robert Gilthorne. The executive producer is Carla Tanella, and I'm Ellen Pritchard.
And now it's time for the Northern Storyteller. Hi, we're the Creek Sisters.
I'm Vicki Andrews.
And I'm Marcia Trainer. And today I'm going to be reading from the book The Seeing Stick by Jane Yolen.
And I'm reading from the book The King of the Pipers by Peter Elwell.
The Seeing Stick. Once, in the ancient walled citadel of Peking, there lived an emperor who had only one daughter, and her name was Huai Ming. Now this daughter had carved ivory combs to smooth back her long black hair. Her tiny feet were encased in embroidered slippers, and she wore robes woven of the finest silks. But instead of making her happy, such possessions only made her sad, for Huai Ming was blind, and none of the beautiful handicrafts of the kingdom brought her any pleasure at all. Her father was also sad that his only daughter was blind, but he couldn't cry for her. He was the emperor, after all, and had given up crying over such things when he ascended the throne. Yet still, he had hoped that one day Huai Ming might be able to see, and he vowed that, if someone could help her, such a person would be rewarded with a fortune in jewels. He sent word of his offer to the inner and outer cities of Peking, and to all the towns and villages for hundreds of miles around. Monks came, of course, with their prayers and their prayer wheels, for they thought in this way to help Huai Ming see. Magician priests came, of course, with their incantations and their spells, for they thought in this way to help Huai Ming see. And physicians came, of course, with their potions and their pins, for they thought in this way to help Huai Ming see. But nothing could help. Huai Ming had been blind since the day of her birth. No one could effect a cure. Now one day, an old man who lived far away in the south country heard tales of the blind princess, and he heard of the emperor's offer. So he took his few possessions, a long walking stick made from a single piece of golden wood, and his whittling knife, and he headed up the road. The sun rose hot on his right, and the sun set cool on his left as the old man made his way north to Peking to help the blind princess see. At last the old man, his clothes all tattered from his journey, stopped by the gate of the outermost city. The guards at the gate didn't want to let such a ragged old man in. "Go home, grandfather," they said. "There's nothing here for such as you." The old man reached out and touched their faces in turn with his rough fingers. "So young," he said, "and already so old." He turned as if to go, and then he propped his walking stick against his side and he reached into his shirt for his whittling knife. "What are you doing there, grandfather?" asked one of the guards when he saw the old man bring out his knife. "Ah," he said, "I'm going to show you my stick, for it is a stick of seeds." "That's nonsense," said the second guard. "That stick can see no further than can the emperor's daughter." Just so, said the old man. "Stranger things have happened." And so saying, he picked up his walking stick and he struck the knife blade back and forth three times to sharpen its edge. As the guards watched from the gate in the wall, the old man began to tell them how he had walked the many miles through towns and villages until at last he came to the walls of Peking with his seeing stick. And as he told them his tale, he pointed to the pictures in the stick. There was the old man, his home, the long walk. And as they watched further, he began to carve their portraits into the wood. The two guards looked at each other in amazement and delight. They were flattered at their likenesses on the old man's stick. Indeed, they'd never seen such carving skill. "Certainly this is something that the guards of the inner city should see," they said. So taking the old man by the arm, They led him through the streets of the outermost city, past flower peddlers and rice sellers, past silk weavers and jewel merchants, up to the great stone walls. Now, when the guards of the inner city saw the seeing stick, they were amazed. "Carve our faces, too," they begged like children, and laughing and touching their faces in turn as any fond grandfather would. The old man did as they bid. In no time at all, the guards of the inner city took the old man by the arm and led him up to the wall and in through the gate to the great wooden doors of the imperial palace. Now, when the guards arrived in the throne room of the imperial palace, leading the old man by the arm, it happened that the emperor's blind daughter, Huai Ming, was sitting at his side. Her hands were clasped before her. She was silent and sightless and still. As the guards finished telling the story of the wonderful pictures carved in the golden wood, the princess clapped her hands. "Oh, I wish I could see that wondrous stick," she said. "Just so, just so," said the old man, "and I will show it to you. For it is no ordinary piece of wood, but a stick that sees." "That's nonsense," said her father in a voice so low it was almost a growl. But the princess didn't hear him. She was already bent forward toward the sound of the old man's voice. "I've seen a stick," she said. The old man didn't say anything for a while, and then he reached out and he petted her head and caressed her cheek. For though she was a princess, she was still a child. Then he began to tell again the story of his long journey. He introduced each character and object. The old man, the guards, the great wall, the innermost city. And then he carved the wooden doors and the imperial palace and the princess into the golden wood. When he was finished, the old man reached out and he took her tiny fingers in his and he placed them on the stick. Finger on finger, he helped her trace the likenesses there. "Feel the long flowing hair of the princess," he said, "grown as she has grown, straight and true." And the princess's slim fingers felt the carved stick. "Now feel your own long hair," he said. And she did. "Feel the lines on the old man's face, from years of worry and years of joy." He thrust the stick into her hands again, and the princess's slim fingers felt the carved stick. Then he put her fingers on to his own face, and he helped her trace the same lines there. It was the first time that the princess had touched another person's face since she was a very small child. The princess jumped up on her throne and she thrust her hands before her. "Guards, oh guards," she cried, "come here to me." And the guards lifted up their faces to the princess Huaiming's hands. Her fingers, like little breezes, brushed their eyes and noses and mouths, and then found each one on the carved stick. She turned to her father, the emperor, then, who sat straight and tall and unmoving on his great throne. And her fingers ran eagerly through his hair and down his nose and cheek, and rested curiously on a tear they found there. And that was strange, for hadn't the emperor given up crying over such things when he ascended the throne? They led her through the streets of the city then, the emperor in the lead, and the princess Huai Ming touched men and women and children as they passed, until at last they reached the great wall and she touched the very stones themselves. She turned to the old man then. Her voice was bright and full of laughter. "Tell me another story," she said. "Tomorrow, if you wish," he replied. For each tomorrow, as long as he lived, the old man dwelt in the innermost city, where only the royal family stays. The emperor rewarded him with a fortune in jewels, but he gave them all away. Each day, he'd tell the princess a story. Some were as ancient as the city itself, and some were as new as the events of the day, and each time he carved wonderful pictures into the stick of golden wood. As the princess listened, she grew eyes on the tips of her fingers. At least, that's what she told all the other blind children whom she taught to see as she saw. Certainly it was as true as saying that she had a seeing stick. But the blind princess Huai Ming believed that both things were true, and so did all the other blind children in her city of Peking. And so did the blind old man. The King of the Pipers. Once upon a time, there lived a humble woodsman with his wife and a son named Jack. Jack was known far and wide for his ability to play the bagpipes. In fact, no one could play quite as badly as Jack, which is why when he decided to walk out into the world and seek his fortune, his parents were not entirely displeased. So with a song in his heart, and not the slightest idea of how to play it, Jack strolled off down the dusty road. As he made his way through the countryside, Jack offered to play for anyone who'd listen. Of course, no one would, but not wishing to hurt his feelings or be killed by his tune, they'd all say, "Oh, you're much too good to be playing for the likes of me. You should play for the king." Thanking them for the compliment, Jack set off toward the palace. A swift and breathless messenger brought the news of Jack's intent to the king. "Here's trouble, sire. Jack the Piper's coming this way." The king, busy cheating at cards with his lucky dwarf, was terrified. "What thousand devils," he cried. "Someone had better stop him before he does something highly unpleasant to mine royal ears." The wisest counselors were summoned, and after much counsel and wiseness, it was decided that Sir Giles, the somewhat impolite, was just the man for the job. Sir Giles, with a bravery bred of too many dents to the helm, armed himself to the teeth and strode out to meet Jack. Seeing a man in armor, Jack assumed he'd been sent by the king to welcome him. Sir Giles shouted, "You ugly baboon! I'll split you like a chicken!" His helmet, however, muffled his words, so Jack, thinking Sir Giles had said, "Play me a tune and make it a quick one," started to play away. At the sound of Jack's pipe, the joints in Sir Giles' armor froze solid, forcing him to hear the entirety of Jack's medley. Thanking him for his attentiveness, Jack walked on, failing to notice he'd turned Sir Giles to stone. When he heard of Sir Giles' sad fate, the king turned to his counselors, asking, "Now what are we going to do?" Wise guys all, the counselors replied, "What do you mean, we? You're the one he wants to play for." Then the king spied his lucky dwarf, and before the dwarf could make for the exit, he grabbed him, exchanged clothes, and joined his counselors in a mad dash for the hills. They were never seen again. The dwarf, not wishing to be turned to stone or any substance other than dwarf, was willing to give Jack most anything to keep him from playing. Thus, dressed as the king, he greeted Jack. "Ah, worthy subject," he said. "What do you seek?" I don't know," replied Jack. "The house? A job? A wife, maybe?" "Say no more. Today's your lucky day." The dwarf then proceeded to give him the palace, the king's crown, and the king's daughter, Esmeralda. Since it wasn't the custom for a groom to play at his own wedding, Jack and Esmeralda's ceremony went reasonably well, and no one was turned to stone. It would be safe to say that Esmeralda was less than pleased with matters as they stood. After all, she had been married off to a poor piper by a man far shorter than the father she remembered, and whenever she asked him about his change in size, he'd just mumble something about being enchanted. So, feeling rather unhappy, Esmeralda took to moping in her garden. One day, out of the blue, a handsome stranger appeared. After he strummed his gentle lute and sung a lovely song about the moon, he told Esmeralda that he was a prince in disguise, and he'd come to take her to his kingdom in a faraway land. Esmeralda didn't know whether to believe him or not, but he was charming, and when he played his lute, she didn't have to worry about becoming a lawn ornament. So she stole away with him that very night. As they hurried along, one of the stranger's shoes slipped off. To Esmeralda's surprise, she saw that the stranger had, instead of a foot, a goat's hoof. "Excuse me," said Esmeralda, "but you never said anything about having hooves." "A slight oversight on my part," replied the stranger, and he bowed, doffing his cap to reveal a small pair of horns on his head. "Something's not quite right here," Esmeralda said to herself as she looked at the stranger. His entire appearance had changed by now. He was, in fact, as ugly as the devil, which was no wonder, for he was the devil. Before Esmeralda had put two and two together, the devil grabbed her and flew off to his kingdom of darkness. In an effort to keep Jack away from his pipe, the lucky dwarf, who was now lucky chief counselor, had kept Jack busy by having him continually signing decrees and making up new laws. Thus it was several days before Jack noticed Esmeralda was missing. When he did, he asked the dwarf for advice. With a glint in his eye, the dwarf said, "I'd look for her if I were you. It could take a long, long time, but don't let that stop you." Taking the lucky dwarf's advice, Jack put aside crown and kingdom to look for Esmeralda. For 3 years he wandered, but at no time in those 3 years did he even find a trace of her. Finally, ragged and worn, and having searched to the ends of the earth, Jack said, "Well, if she's not in this world, she's got to be in the next." And he set out for the kingdom of darkness. When Jack arrived, the devil appeared in an effective puff of smoke, surrounded by a pack of nasty-looking little demons. Jack could tell by the devil's wicked smile that his search was now at an end. "You've got my wife. If you don't mind, I'd like her back." "Forget it," said the devil. "She's mine. Now go away before we eat you alive." The prospect of seeing Jack roasting on a spit pleased the little demons no end. They danced with glee. When, instead of leaving, Jack said, "Maybe if I favored you with a tune, you'd see things in a different light." The devil shouted, "Grab him, boys! We're having a guest for dinner!" But before the demons could do their dirty deed, the air was split by the sound of Jack's pipe. "Enough!" howled the devil. "You can have your wife!" Jack stopped playing, and the devil brought out Esmeralda. "Thank you," said Jack, taking Esmeralda's hand. The devil, being a proper swine, did not say you're welcome, but chose to kick one of his smaller demons and yell something about plagues and vipers. When Jack and Esmeralda returned to the world, it was dark and a cold rain was falling. They walked and walked, but didn't say much. After all, up to this point, they really hadn't done all that well by each other, and they knew it. The rain wasn't making things any cheerier, so, seeing a small hut, Jack went up and knocked on the door. A bent old woman answered, and without saying a word, beckoned them in. Jack asked the old woman if she might have some wood for a fire, but she just smiled. It seemed the only wood in the place fit to be burned was his bagpipes. "Well," said Jack to Esmeralda, "after all this time and trouble, I'm not going to have you freeze to death." And he immediately tossed his pipe into the hearth. Quite as if by magic, they burst into flame. Knowing how Jack's heart broke to see his pipes burn, Esmeralda reached into the blaze and pulled them out. Mysteriously, the fire didn't burn her, and when she looked at what she held, she saw that these weren't the old wooden pipes that Jack had tossed in. These pipes were made of gold and ivory, and they shimmered and glistened, seeming to give off a light all their own. Suddenly, the old woman burst out laughing, and as she did so, a beard sprang from her face, and she began to grow. When she cast off her old rags, it was revealed that this was no one less than the King of the Fairies. "You've both done well," said the King, "and these pipes are your reward. They're fairy pipes, and they don't know a wrong note." To say Esmeralda was relieved would be putting it lightly. The Fairy King clapped his hands, and the hut vanished, leaving them out under a starry sky. With another clap of his hands, he summoned up the western wind, who blew them into the air and home. Back once more in his kingdom, Jack became known far and wide as the King of the Pipers. The fairy pipes could do no wrong, so long as the heart of the person playing them beat true, and no heart beat truer than Jack's. Time proved kind, and Esmeralda and Jack grew to love each other greatly. The lucky dwarf, on the other hand, was simply happy to know he wouldn't be turned to stone. When Jack and Esmeralda's baby was born, the lucky dwarf was named Lucky Uncle, and through his understanding of short folk, he proved the child's dearest companion and friend. Thus, it might be said that they all lived happily ever after.
You've been listening to the story, The King of the Pipers, by Peter Elwell, published by Macmillan. And before that, you heard The Steam Stick by Jane Yolen, published by Thomas Crowell Company.
Mm-hmm.
Northern Storyteller is a production of KUACFM at the University of Alaska, Fairbanks. Our program is coordinated by Ron Inlay.
Our engineer is Robert Gil Fillon. And the executive producer is none other than Carla Tanella.
And I'm Vicki Andrews.
I'm Marcia Traynor. Have a good day.
And now it's time for the Northern Storyteller. Hi, I'm Marion Flowers. Today I'll be reading from the book Wiley and the Hairy Man, adapted from an American folktale by Molly Garrett Bang. It was a long time ago. Wiley and his mother lived near a swamp. The swamp was near the Tom Bigbee River. One day, Wiley wanted to cut some bamboo. He needed poles for the hen roost. He got his axe to go down to the swamp. Wiley's mother said, "Wiley, be careful when you go to the swamp. Take your hound dogs with you. The hairy man will get you if you don't watch out." Wiley's mother knew the hairy man hated hound dogs. She knew because she knew all about the ways of the swamp. She had grown up on the Tom Bigbee River. Wiley said, "I'll watch out. I'll take my hound dogs with me everywhere I go." But when he got to the swamp, his dogs saw a wild pig. They ran after it. They ran so far away, Wiley couldn't even hear them yelp. "Well," thought Wiley, "I hope the hairy man isn't anywhere around here." He took his axe and began to cut poles. When Wiley looked up, there was the hairy man. He was coming through the trees. He sure was ugly. He was hairy all over. His eyes burned like coal. His teeth were big and sharp and white. He was swinging a sack. Wiley was scared. Quick as he could, he climbed up a big bay tree. Wiley had seen that the hairy man had feet like a cow, and Wiley knew a cow could not climb a tree. The hairy man stood at the foot of the tree. He called, "Wiley, what are you doing up there?" Wiley said, "My mother told me to stay away from you." Then Wiley asked, "What's in your big old sack?" "Nothing yet," the hairy man said. He picked up Wiley's axe and began to chop down the tree. Well, Wiley held tight to the tree. He rubbed his belly against it. Then he hollered, "Fly, Chips, fly! Fly back to your same old place!" The chips flew back. The hairy man chopped faster. Wiley hollered as fast as he could, but the hairy man was faster. The chips flew and flew. The hairy man was winning. Then from way far off, Wiley heard his hound dog yelping. "Here, dogs," he hollered. The dogs came running. As soon as the hairy man saw them, he fled away into the swamp. When Wiley got home, he told his mother what had happened. "Did the hairy man have his sack with him?" she asked. "Yes, ma'am, he did," said Wiley. "Well," his mother said, "the next time the hairy man comes after you, don't climb the tree. Just stay on the ground and say, 'Hello, hairy man.' Then hairy man will say, 'Hello, Wiley.' Then you say, 'I hear you're the best conjure man around here.'" "What's conjure?" Wiley asked his mother. She answered, "It's magic." She went on, "You tell him he is the best conjure man, and he'll say, 'I reckon I am.' Then you say, 'I bet you can't change yourself into a giraffe.'
and he will change himself into a giraffe. Then you say, I bet you can't change yourself into an alligator. And he will change himself into an alligator. You keep telling him what he can't do. He'll keep doing it just to show you. Then you say, everybody can change into something big. I bet you can't change yourself into a little possum. He will change into a little possum. You grab him right away and throw him into the sack. Then you take the sack and throw it into the river. Wilder was scared to do what his mother said. But the next time he had to go to the swamp, he tied up his hound dog. As soon as he got to the swamp, Wilder saw the hairy man. He was coming at him through the trees. He was swinging his sack. He was grinning because he knew Wilder had left his hound dog behind. Wilder wanted to run away, but he stayed there. He said, hello, hairy man. And the hairy man said, hello, Wilder. Hairy man, said Wilder, I hear you're the best conjure man around here.
I reckon I am, said the hairy man.
I bet you can't change yourself into a giraffe, said Wilder.
Sure I can, the hairy man said.
That's no trouble at all. The hairy man twisted around and he changed himself into a giraffe. And Wilder said, I bet you can't change yourself into an alligator. The giraffe twisted around and changed itself into an alligator. So Wiley said, everybody can change into something big. I bet you can't change yourself into a little possum. The alligator twisted around and changed itself into a little possum. Wiley grabbed the possum and threw it into the hairy man's sack. He tied the sack as tight as he could. Then he threw the sack into the Tom Bigby River. Wiley started home through the swamp. Oh, he felt happy. But he hadn't gone far when there was the hairy man again. He was coming at Wiley. Wiley climbed right up the nearest tree. How did you get out? He called down to the hairy man. I changed myself into the wind and blew my way out. Now I'm going to wait right down here. You'll get hungry, and you'll come down out of that tree. Wiley thought and thought. He thought about the hairy man waiting below. He thought about his hound dog tied up at home. After a while, Wiley said, hairy man, you did some pretty good tricks, but I bet you can't make things disappear. The hairy man said, ha! That's what I'm best at. See the bird's nest on that branch? Wiley looked. It was there. Then it was gone. But Wiley said, I never saw it in the first place. I bet you can't make something I know is there disappear. Look at your shirt, Wiley, the hairy man said. Wiley looked down. His shirt was gone. Oh, that was just a plain old shirt, he said. But this rope around my pants is magic. My mother conjured it. I bet you can't make this rope disappear, the hairy man said. I can make all the rope in this county disappear. I bet you can, said Wiley. The hairy man threw out his chest. He opened his mouth wide and he hollered loud. All the rope in this county disappear. The rope around Wiley's pants was gone. He held his pants up with one hand. He held onto the tree with the other, and he hollered loud, "Here, dog!" The dog came running, and the hairy man fled away. When Wiley got home, he told his mother what happened. Well, she said, you fooled the hairy man twice. If we can fool him one more time, he'll never come back to bother us again. But he'll be mighty hard to fool the third time. Wiley's mother sat down in a rocking chair, and she thought. Wiley couldn't sit still. He went outside and tied up one dog at the front door. He tied up the other dog at the back door. Then he came inside. He crossed a broom with an axe over the window. He built a fire in the fireplace. Then he sat down and helped his mother think. After a while, she said, Wiley, go down to the pen and bring me back a young pig. Wiley went down to the pen and brought her back a piglet. She put the piglet in Wiley's bed. His mother said, Wiley, you go up to the loft and hide. Wiley climbed up to the loft. He looked out front through a knot hole in a plank. He saw a great big animal run out of the swamp toward the house. The dog out front broke loose and chased the animal back into the swamp. Wiley looked out back through a crack between the planks. He saw another animal run out of the swamp toward the house. The other dog broke loose and chased the animal back into the swamp. The wind howled and the house shook. Wiley heard footsteps on the roof over his head. It was the hairy man. He was trying to come down the chimney. When the hairy man touched the chimney and found it was hot, he cursed and swore. Then he jumped down from the roof and walked right up to the front door. He banged on it and yelled out, Mama, I've come for your youngin'. But Wiley's mother called back, You can't have him, hairy man. The hairy man said, I'll set your house on fire with lightning. I'll burn it down if you don't get him to me. But Wiley's mother called back, I have plenty of sweet milk, hairy man. The milk will put out your fire. Then the hairy man said, I'll dry up your cow. I'll dry up your spring. I'll send 1,000,000 boll weevils out of the ground to eat up your cotton if you don't give me your yummy. Hairy man, said Wiley's mother, you wouldn't do all that. That's mighty mean. I'm a mighty mean man, said the hairy man. So Wiley's mother said, If I do give you the young'un, will you go away and never come back? I swear I will, said the hairy man. Wiley's mother opened the door. He's over in that bed, she said. The hairy man grinned. He walked over to the bed. He snatched the covers back. Hey, he yelled, there's nothing in this bed but a young pig. I never said which young'un I'd give you, Wiley's mother answered. The hairy man stomped his feet. He gnashed his teeth. He raged and yelled. Then he grabbed the piglet and fled away into the swamp. Wiley came down from the loft. Is the hairy man gone for good? He sure is, said Wiley's mother. He can't ever get you now. Wiley and his mother had fooled the hairy man 3 times, and they never saw him again. You've been listening to a story from the book Wiley and the Hairy Man, adapted from an American folktale by Molly Garrett Bang, published by Macmillan Publishing Company. Northern Storyteller is a production of KUAC-FM at the University of Alaska Fairbanks. Our program is coordinated by Ron Inouye. Our engineer is Robert Gilfillan. The executive producer is Carla Tanella. And I'm Marion Flowers.